7. A Herf Gun in Frith Street. Big End was telling a story. Over drinks in a crowded Frith Street tapas place, Hollis suspected she'd been to before. A story about someone using something called a Herf Gun, high-energy radio frequency, in Moscow, to erase someone else's stored data, in a drive in an adjacent building on the opposite side of a party wall. So far, the best thing about it was that Big End kept using the British expression party wall, and she had always found it mildly, if inexplicably, comical. The Herf Gun, he was explaining now, the electromagnetic radiation device, was the size of a backpack, putting out a 16-megawatt pulse. And she suddenly found herself afraid, boys being boys, of some punchline involving accidentally baked internal organs. "Were any animals harmed, Hubertus?" she interrupted, "in the making of this anecdote?"
"I like animals," said Milgrim, the American Big End had introduced at Blue Ant, sounding as though he were more than mildly surprised to discover that he did. He seemed to have only the one name. After Clammy had decided to go back to the studio, her white plastic bottle of cold FX wedged precariously into a back pocket of his hounds, departing the Golden Square Starbucks during an unexpected burst of weak, but thoroughly welcome sunlight. Hollis had gone out to stand for a few moments, amid the puddles in Golden Square, before walking, aimlessly, she'd pretended to herself, back up Upper James to Beak Street. Turning right, crossing the first intersection on her side of Beak, she'd found Blue Ant exactly where she remembered it, while simultaneously realising that she'd been hoping it somehow wouldn't be there. When she'd pressed the annunciator button, a square pattern of small round holes had said hello.
"Hollis Henry, for Hubertus."
Was she expected?
"Not at all, no."
A handsome bearded child, in a corduroy sports coat considerably older than he was, had opened the thick glass door almost immediately.
"I'm Jacob," he'd said. "We're just trying to find him."
He'd offered his hand.
"Hollis," she'd said. "Come in, please. I'm a huge fan of the curfew."
"Thank you."
"Would you like coffee while you wait?"
He'd indicated a sort of guardhouse, diagonally striped in artfully battered yellow and black paint, in which a girl with very short blonde hair was polishing an espresso maker that looked set to win at Le Mans.
"They sent 3 men from Turin to install the machine."
"Shouldn't I be being photographed?" she'd asked him. Inchmail hadn't liked Blue Ant's new security measures at all when they'd last come here to sign contracts. But then the phone in Jacob's right hand had played the opening chords of Box 1 of 1, one of her least favourite curfew songs. She'd pretended not to notice.
"In the lobby," he'd said to the phone.
"Have you been with Blue Ant long?" she'd asked.
2 years now. I actually worked on your commercial. We were gutted when it fell through. Do you know Damien?"
She didn't.
"The director. Gutted, absolutely."
But then Big End had appeared, in his very blue suit, shoulder draped in the bivouac tent yardage of the trench coat, and accompanied by Pamela Mannering, and a nondescript but unshaven man, in a thin cotton sports coat and wrinkled slacks, a black nylon bag slung over his shoulder.
"This is Milgrim," Big End had said.
Then, "Hollis Henry," to the man, who'd said,
"Hello,"
but scarcely anything since.
"What kinds of animals?"
she asked him now, in a still more naked bid to derail Big End's narrative. Milgrim winced.
"Dogs,"
he said quickly, as though surprised in some guilty pleasure.
"You like dogs?"
She was sure that Big End had been paying whatever lowlife had been wielding that Herf gun, though he'd never come right out and tell you that, unless he had some specific reason to.
"I met a very nice dog in Basel," Milgram said, "at..." A micro-expression of anxiety. "At a friend's." "Your friend's dog?"
"Yes," said Milgram,
nodding once, tightly, before taking a sip of his Coke.
"You could have used a spark coil generator instead," he said to Big End,
blinking.
"Made from a VCR tuner. They're smaller."
"Who told you that?" asked Big End, suddenly differently focused.
Roommate?
Milgram extended an index finger to touch his stack of tiny, elongated white china tapas dishes, as if needing to assure himself that they were there.
"He worried about things like that. Out loud. They made him angry."
He looked apologetically at Hollis.
"I see," said Big End,
although Hollis certainly didn't. Now Milgram took a pharmacist's folded white bubble pack from an inside jacket pocket, flattened it, and frowned with concentration. All of the pills, Hollis saw, were white as well, white capsules, though of differing sizes. He carefully pushed three of them through the foil backing, put them in his mouth, and washed them down with a swig of Coke.
"You must be exhausted, Milgram," said Pamela, seated beside Hollis. "You're on East Coast time."
"Not too bad,"
Milgram said, putting the bubble pack away. There was a curious lack of definition to his features, Hollis thought. Something adolescent, though she guessed he was in his 30s. He struck her as unused to inhabiting his own face, somehow. As amazed to find himself who he was, as to find himself here in Frith Street, eating oysters and calamari and dry-shaved ham.
"Aldous will take you back to the hotel," Pamela said.
Aldous, Hollis guessed, was one of the two black men who'd walked over with them from Blue Ant, carrying long furled umbrellas with beautifully lacquered cane handles. They were waiting outside now, a few feet apart, silently, keeping an eye on Big End through the window.
"Where is it?"
Milgram asked.
"Covent Garden," said Pamela.
"I like that one," he said.
He folded his napkin, put it beside the white china tower. He looked at Hollis.
"Nice meeting you."
He nodded, first to Pamela, then to Big End.
"Thanks for dinner."
Then he pushed back his chair, bent to pick up his bag, stood up, shouldering the bag, and walked out of the restaurant.
"Where did you find him?" Hollis asked,
watching Milgram, through the window, speak to the one she supposed was Aldous.
"In Vancouver," Big End said, "a few weeks after you were there."
"What does he do?"
"Translation," Big End said. "Simultaneous and written. Russian. Brilliant with idioms."
"Is he... well?"
She didn't know how else to put it.
"Convalescing," said Big End.
"Recovering," said Pamela.
"He translates for you?"
"Yes, though we're beginning to see that he may actually be more useful in other areas."
"Other areas?"
"Good eye for detail," said Big End. "We have him looking at clothing."
"Doesn't look like a fashion plate."
"That's an advantage, actually," said Big End.
"Did he notice your suit?"
"He didn't say," said Big End, glancing down at an international Klein blue lapel of early Carnaby proportions.
He looked up, pointedly, at her hound's jacket.
"Have you learned anything?"
He rolled a piece of the dry, translucent Spanish ham, waiting for her answer. His hand fed the ham to his mouth carefully, as if afraid of being bitten. He chewed.
"It's what the Japanese call a secret brand," Hollis said. "Only more so. This may or may not have been made in Japan.
No regular retail outlets, no catalogue, no web presence aside from a few cryptic mentions on fashion blogs, and eBay. Chinese pirates have started to fake it, but only badly. The minimal gesture. If a genuine piece turns up on eBay, someone will make an offer that introduces the seller to stop the auction. Turning to Pamela, "Where did you get this jacket?"
"We advertised. On fashion fora, mainly. Eventually we found a dealer in Amsterdam and met his price. He ordinarily deals in unworn examples of anonymously designed mid-20th century workwear."
"He does?"
"Not unlike rare stamps, apparently, except that you can wear them. A segment of his clientele appreciates Gabriel Hounds, though they're a minority among what we take to be the brand's demographic. We're guessing active global brand awareness, meaning people who go to very considerable trouble to find it, tops out at no more than a few thousand."
"Where did the dealer in Amsterdam get his?"
"He claimed to have bought it as part of a lot of vintage new old stock from a picker, without having known what it was. Said he'd assumed they were otaku-grade Japanese reproductions of vintage, and that he could probably resell them easily enough."
"A picker?"
"Someone who looks for things to sell to dealers. He said that the picker was German and a stranger. A cash transaction. Claimed not to recall a name."
"It can't be that big a secret," Hollis said. "I've found two people since breakfast who knew at least as much about it as I've told you."
"And they are?"
Big End leaned forward. "The Japanese woman at a very pricey specialist shop, not far from Blue Ant."
"Ah," he said, his disappointment obvious. "And?"
"A young man who bought a pair of jeans in Melbourne."
"Really?" said Big End, brightening. "And did he tell you who he bought them from?"
Hollis picked up a slice of the glycine ham, rolled it, dipped it in olive oil. "No, but I think he will."